ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why can't I get into my computer? Mark, sorry to bother you again. Do you know how to get in touch with our IT team? I can't get into my computer. Okay, call them internal number 443. Okay, great. There's no phones on our desk, though. Oh, right, the phone is part of the IT system, which is in my computer. Right. Hello, I'm Lisa Leong, and you're listening to This Working Life on ABC Radio National, helping to make your work life better. What has your experience been like at starting a new job? Onboarding is critical, but often not done very well. This episode, why is it so hard to start fresh, and how could we be doing it better? Dr. Talia Bauer is Professor of Management at Portland State University. She's been studying onboarding at companies big and small for 30 years. Hello, Talia.
Hi.
So my feeling is that good onboarding is the exception and not the rule, but what has your research actually revealed?
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on. When we ask employees what they think, only a handful say that they really experienced great onboarding. Studies range from 63 to 88% of employees saying that their organization just didn't do a great job.
And how would you define onboarding then?
I'm an academic, so I kind of have an academic definition, but I'm also really keen on translating research. So I call it or define it as the process of people moving from organizational outsiders to organizational insiders. So it's not rocket science, although they've used my work at NASA, so it works with rocket scientists. But I think part of why it's so challenging for organizations is there's so many demands. And the thinking is, well, you know, you're only new for a few minutes, really. It's, you know, days, weeks, months, and it all seems to work out no matter what we do, so why worry about it? This magical point in time where if you have some empathy and go back and put yourself in those shoes, then you can be really effective. But it's hard for people to do that. We want to forget anxiety and anxious times. We want to forget when we weren't good at things. And being new kind of brings up that new kid in school feeling. So people like to quickly get past it.
Mm. You talk about anxiety from the new starter's point of view, and that explains a little bit about why it might be challenging from the new starter's point of view. But why is it so challenging to do good onboarding from an organizational point of view?
As you mentioned, I've been doing this for 30 years. And when I started, it was really not a mainstream topic. It was, you know, obviously part of the HR function, but it wasn't a very important or well thought of one. And then all of a sudden, I started getting calls from Microsoft and Google, and the Fortune 500 were very interested in doing this better. And, you know, it really makes sense why they would want to when we look now at kind of world-class onboarding versus poor onboarded people and organizations. Those who are world-class are getting 2.5% greater productivity. They're seeing less turnover. They're seeing really employees who are more confident, more clear, more connected. They're more satisfied, they stay longer, and they're more productive while they're there. So I kind of think of it as this magic pill. If you could ask organizations what they want, that would be it. And all of a sudden, people kind of caught on to this, and onboarding became quite important to organizations. That doesn't mean, though, that the focus and the ability to continue to do it well and refresh and do that check back is happening. And so, you know, that's really key.
Now, Talia, does this mean that big organizations often are able to do it more than small organizations? Because obviously you've mentioned some of the big ones, right?
Yeah, that's where I've done a lot of my work. I've done studies at organizations, as you mentioned, big and small. A lot of my samples are college graduates, so they're going to all sorts of different companies. But what the big companies can do is the consistency part, and consistency is really key. They can also dedicate full-time staff who are involved in the onboarding process. But it's hard. It's kind of like being a college professor and teaching for 30 years. Somebody asked me once, you know, how do I keep it interesting and don't I get bored of teaching the same material in classes? And I think it's really goes back to that empathy. Yes, I have taught it a million times at that point, but for the student, it's brand new. And I try and keep that in mind. So that's, I think, a key part of it is that you keep it fresh for the people who are new. But the other challenge for organizations is the way that it was when you came through and now you're a manager or an executive, the culture has changed. The culture is the bottom of the pyramid. And there's so many people who are there and it shifts and it's very hard to see that. And so it's also important to kind of learn from those newcomers.
Now, what are some of the red flags in your mind for poor onboarding when it's done badly?
Yeah, haphazard. You know, that would be the one, the sink or swim. People get onboarded whether you plan it or not, whether or not you have a great program or not. And so there are some people who are going to be effective. They're proactive. They're kind of talented. They're lucky maybe. But there are people who are going to fall through the cracks in that system and you're going to lose them. And so you've invested a lot to identify them, recruit them, bring them on, you know, and then you're just kind of wasting that talent.
Do you think that you can onboard yourself?
Absolutely. So we know from research really clearly that people who are more proactive are much better at onboarding. They get better outcomes. They onboard more quickly. And so they're asking for feedback. They're taking the risks. They're putting themselves out there. They're volunteering for things. And so those are the things that really make a difference for individuals. So again, some people in that sink or swim environment are going to have the personality, the temperament, the skills to navigate it really well. It's just that not everyone does. The good news is we did some research at Google. You can actually prompt people to be more proactive. Tell them about the research. Who doesn't want that? So somebody who maybe that's not comfortable for them initially or their natural inclination, if you tell them this is what we expect from you and we'll help you be more effective, they're actually more than willing to do that. And that really kind of pays off.
Let's look at world-class onboarding then, because this is really the body of your work and you've really managed to give us a bit of a model. So do you want to take us through it?
You know, again, academics like to have technical names and psychological terms and kind of jargon in our articles. And so I tried to kind of simplify it, approach it as managers might want to see it through their lens. And so I created the C's of onboarding. And so it's really kind of starting with compliance. That's not the exciting one, but it sure is an important foundation. And this is something people were always doing no matter what. The worst onboarding, they're still looking at the legal framework. They're still making sure you have a computer, that you have a desk, that we're filling out the paperwork, you know where the bathrooms are. Those things are happening no matter what. But what isn't always happening is really good clarity and helping people to understand not just what is the job or the job title, but what are the expectations, the norms, who are you supposed to be interacting with, et cetera. So that's really important. And then people don't spend a lot of time focusing on the newcomer's confidence. So we talked about that anxiety. But if you can make somebody feel more confident or help them feel less incompetent early on, they're going to thrive and they're going to appreciate you as an organization and the individuals within it. And then the big one, I think, where my research has made a big difference in changing how organizations thought about onboarding was connection. And early on, my argument was always that connection was the most important of all of them. I think most of us think clarity, get them in, get them doing the job. You know, we want that payoff for our investment. But turns out when you do connection first, they feel more supported, more willing to take those chances, ask questions, and then all those other good outcomes come.
Talia, just on the connection point, what do you find is the most effective way to cultivate that connection?
Yeah, it's, again, not complicated, but it's really important. A lot of it has to do with the timing. So the same behavior a month after you join versus the first day, first week can make a huge difference. So in my research, I found that meeting your manager on the first day, meeting your team on the first day can make a difference. You wouldn't think 3 months later it would, but it affects your adjustment. Also, having an assigned buddy. People who have assigned buddies do much better than those who don't. And so that's just really kind of important. And it's something that you can do poorly or well. So if you kind of just say, oh, here's a buddy and don't have any buddy training, you don't have any consistency there. Again, it's kind of hit or miss, right? Some people are going to do well, connect, others won't.
Yeah, beautiful. All right. So far we've got compliance, clarification, confidence, connection. Where do we go from here?
Well, culture is really important. Understanding the culture of an organization. And like I said, that's a slippery one. You know, there's the artifacts and the stories we tell about our organizations, but culture shifts over time. You know, during my time at Google, they were going from 20,000 to 29,000. And that was a dramatic shift. those numbers are kind of cute now, right? In terms of the scope and the number of people. But when you're bringing in 9,000 new people, that's going to make a difference to the culture. And so the newcomer needs to understand that, and the organization needs to make sure that they're being consistent over time and letting that culture evolve. Those are really important. And then later on, I decided it was really important to add the check back, because so many organizations were doing a good job up front, but there were some spots where there was room for improvement, and they just didn't have that formal built-in process to ask newcomers what was working. Did your manager actually do the things that they were supposed to do? Is there anything we can improve on? And so that check back is really important.
Do you have an example from your consulting work with companies as to a good example of how you would show culture and inculcate someone into that culture when they are onboarded?
I mean, a lot of it is, almost something with remote, it becomes harder. But if you have a headquarters and the artifacts, statues, the way the office is laid out will say a lot about the playfulness or the seriousness of the culture. Are people dressed in suits? Are they wearing t-shirts and flip-flops? So those are definitely important. There's rituals, so the rituals at Google versus Microsoft are very different. And one is more playful at Google, and Microsoft is much more serious. And so at Hewlett-Packard, even more so. These are kind of serious research scientists who would not do a lot of the playful things that they do at Google. And so you get a sense of things that way. And then finally, the stories we tell, right? So the stories about founders, about the history, about what has worked and what hasn't worked. Even legal compliance officers will be talking about stories of newcomers past and where they've gone wrong and things they've done, well-intentioned, but cautionary tales. So all of those things become part of the culture.
You're with Lisa Leong, ABC Radio National's This Working Life, and I'm with Dr. Talia Bauer, Professor of Management at Portland State University, who's been researching onboarding at companies for 30 years. Later, what steps can you take to up your onboarding game? Let's say you were a manager of a smaller team. Could you take the six C's of world-class onboarding and start to try and map things out just for your team and how you onboard people to your team?
Absolutely, because a lot of the best practices are kind of universal, right? So the jobs might vary, the level of the job might vary, but I've studied bankers and executives and high-tech workers and apprentices in France even. And onboarding best practices tend to be that the plan is written down, so you know what they're going to go through. It's tracked over time, that check back. It's participatory. You're checking in with the newcomers and asking them what's working and not working for them. It's consistent. That's probably the biggest one I see organizations fall down on. And they have milestones. So, at 30 days, we're checking in. At 60 days, we're checking in. At 90 days, 6 months, a year. And it's kind of hard for people to imagine that for that whole first year that that's part of onboarding. But again, I think that's where the research made a difference. That practice really thought of it as the orientation, the first day, the first week, maybe a month, and then you weren't new anymore. But the research is really clear that you're changing at those kind of key 3 months, 6 months milestones. And so checking back in can be really important with that. And then evaluate what's working and what's not. So that's something that small teams can do. That's something that, big organizations need to do.
And who do you think is responsible ultimately for good onboarding?
That's a great question. It's a team effort. I mean, really, I think where organizations sometimes go wrong is that they think it is just one group, right? So it's only on the newcomer, or it's only on HR, or it's only on the manager. And it just is too big of a mission for that to be true. It really takes all three of those to kind of embrace. And then IT, if they're involved in provisioning in a high-tech organization. So your intro, there was a failure there. Something didn't happen in the provisioning. You didn't have your computer. You didn't have your desk. You if everything's on your computer to set up your phone and you don't have your computer, you can't do anything. Not only are you not very effective, but it's very stressful. And then it makes you wonder how much they value you.
And in your work over 30 years, what trends have you noticed over that time, Talia?
How to use technology effectively. I think organizations are still struggling with what is the right amount, tone, tools to get that done. Before COVID, the research was really clear that hybrid was a great way to do it, that having people come in together in person first, establishing that trust and the intimacy and the connection, then really didn't make any difference in the outcome if you went remote after that. But obviously, we couldn't do that during COVID, and so it became very different. The research is showing that satisfaction is still highest with hybrid, doing both. Maybe 75% of newcomers are pretty happy with that. On the other hand, in-person and remote aren't terribly behind that, kind of 73, 71%. So the good news is it's not so much how you do it, it's what you do during that process.
I remember in the midst of COVID, one of our large companies here, Talia, just basically took their 2 or 3 day face-to-face induction program and put it all just online. So you had to sit in front of your computer for 3 days, basically.
Painful. Painful.
Which was so painful. So, you know, I guess how formal does an induction program or an onboarding process need to be, do you think?
You know, I don't think the formality matters at all. Consistency matters, but every organization has a different culture, a different personality. And so some are going to be more playful and some are going to be more serious. So I don't think that matters as much. The research is also really clear that when you value and listen to newcomers, that's the most powerful way that with anybody, right, to get buy-in. And so less about telling them how great you are and more about finding out what's great about them and how they fit in. And so kind of flipping that script around a bit can be pretty powerful. And it's an informal process. You kind of curate the experience, but don't control every minute of it.
And then how do you use the 6 C's? Like, are you designing it, like mapping out processes for the first 90 days or so?
Absolutely. I'm kind of cognizant and making sure that I'm trying to touch on every one of the 6 C's throughout the process. So from the design and that plan written down, and then also checking back, you know, so we actually will survey people on each of those dimensions and see how they're doing. And so when we talk about how are new employees adjusting in the research, it's really looking at these factors and measuring it. And it changes over time. So ironically, at about between 1 month and 3 months, people get very confident. And then it takes a precipitous drop because all of a sudden you're not considered as new anymore. And we tell you the real story. We dump the real work on you. You start hearing all the gossip. And that can be a little shaking for people. And then it tends to go back up at around 6 months. But that's consistent across all the industries, different countries I've studied, that it's not a linear process for sure.
Each week we have a segment called Try This, where we ask our expert guests to nominate one thing our This Working Lifers can try out this week. So, Talia, what is the one thing we can do to bring new employees on well or start well as a new employee?
Yeah, I think the one that I would pick would probably be the buddy. If you're a small organization, rather than just asking Bob or Sally to kind of meet with the person and be their buddy, do a little bit of a training, talk about what they might talk about. So it's not one person's opinion, but it's kind of a collective of what the team thinks is important. If you're a bigger, more formal organization, you could even do some experiments, right? Give half of the people 1 week or give everybody in a given week a buddy and the next week don't, and see how that affects both the buddies and the newcomers. So I think that there's some things that you could kind of play scientist in a good way, because we know the research is really clear that it works. And so how do you make it work within your organization is the key.
I love that so much. And as you say, if you're a playful organization, you make it playful. And then if you're, you know, something else, make it fit to the culture. Talia, because you've done so much deep research in this area, I'd love to know, looking in your crystal ball, where do you see the future going for onboarding?
Yeah, I mean, I see more and more technology, and I try and really focus my research and my consulting on, it's been overused, but high tech, high touch. You know, one without the other just doesn't work. It's very hard if you're a global organization to do high touch all the time. You can't do in person all the time. And these teams are, you know, located throughout the world. But you got to have that touch. If you're only doing the technology and it's only chatbots, that's not going to work either. And so it's about finding that balance. I think that sweet spot, the Goldilocks, is really important.
Talia, thank you so much, and thank you for all the great work that you do.
Thank you.
Aussie workers are staying put. In a recent episode of This Working Life, we heard of the global trend called job hugging, and it looks like Australian employee turnover figures might be supporting this. New numbers out from the Australian HR Institute say employee turnover has dropped by over 11% in the last 6 months. Sarah McCann-Bartlett is the Chief Executive of ARI, the Australian HR Institute. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Lisa.
Welcome back to This Working Life. So what do these new numbers out from ARI show exactly in relation to employee turnover?
So what we've seen over the last 6 months is a reduction in employee turnover by around 11%. At the same time, employers are telling us that recruitment difficulty, so we ask them on a quarterly basis, how difficult is it to recruit employees? Recruitment difficulty has also fallen over the last 6 or 12 months. And we also ask whether any employers have turnover over 20%. And that's been pretty sticky until the start of this year, and we're seeing that coming down as well. So we can see that turnover across a number of measures is falling. Mm. And we think that's a combination of employers not making more redundancies, but also employees saying, look, things are getting a little bit slower out there. There's a bit more uncertainty in the economy. Maybe I'll just stay here and I won't be looking for another job. The other thing is that wages are a bit subdued, so potentially there aren't the big job offers out there as well.
So what are the implications of the numbers that you've just shared?
So it's two sides of the same coin, really. There are pros and cons of lower employee turnover. Mm. On the positive side, employers have been telling us for quite a long time that it's been really tough to get people with the right skills and that recruitment has been very difficult. And that means that they've had skills gaps, they haven't had a full complement of employees, and that's put pressure on the organisation and on current employees. On the other hand, and with that easing, some of those pressures will ease. On the other hand, where you have employees staying put, it doesn't necessarily equate to high levels of employee engagement. Mm. What you'll have is you'll have a mix of employees who are highly engaged, who are wanting to do a really terrific job, and then you've got a proportion of employees who are saying, well, this isn't too bad, I may as well stick around, but don't necessarily have those levels of engagement. And that can mean they're less willing to learn new skills. It can also have a negative effect on organisational culture across the board. So you do need to be able to, as an employer, distinguish between those groups of employees. The other thing that we are seeing is as turnover is falling, employers are saying, at the moment, we don't want to make a high level of redundancies. We're not sure what's happening in the economy. Redundancy intentions have also stayed the same over the last 6 months. So what they're saying instead, employers are saying instead, is I'm going to take the people I have, those highly engaged employees, and I'm going to do a bit of reorganization, restructuring in my organization, and I'm going to focus on reskilling as well. So take those committed employees and give them new skills, new opportunities, potentially new jobs or roles within the organization, but use the talent that we have in order to prepare for a different world of work.
That was Sarah McCann-Bartlett. She's the Chief Executive of ARI, the Australian HR Institute. Thanks for listening to This Working Life. It was produced by Rob Kelly and engineered by Tim James on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. If you'd like to hear more from us, you can like or subscribe to our show on ABC Listen or anywhere you get your podcasts. and please rate and review us while you're there. I'm Lisa Leong. Until next time, love your work.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.